Thanks for listening to the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Doug Gottlieb Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Boom! What up, America? Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. We got a great show for you today. An absolute great show for you. Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. Again, a ton of thanks to our friends at Farmers Insurance who had us out at the Farmers Insurance Open, which is taking place right now down in La Jolla. At Farmers, we've seen almost everything, so we know how to cover almost anything. When it's game time, you have an experienced player to help you stay ahead of the game. Put their experience into play at farmers.com.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Did we get the buyer? Did we get the final tally? Did we win that thing? Like I'm hearing reports we finished in second. So I don't know if it was there a trophy? Was there just an attaboy? Was there a good job? I can only tell you this. The level of investment from CT Pan, who is our pro, was pretty awesome. I was getting text yesterday afternoon driving home from San Diego when CT Pan's like, "What's the deal? I thought we were going to win this thing." And I was like, We come on, CT. We could have used your score in a couple of these holes, but he was super invested in it. We finished second, correct?
Doug, we have an update. Okay. We actually are champions of the South Course as we won the Pro-Am in 2019 yesterday at the Farmers Insurance Open. We were second overall, but Jason Day's group
played the easier course.
They played the North Course, yes. So we are champions of the 2019 Farmers Insurance Pro-Am at the South Course at Torrey Pines. And CT Pan is taking that winning mojo as he is currently just two shots back of John Rahm for the lead at Torrey Pines in round number one.
You know what's amazing about it? And I don't know if we should share these details. He didn't play well yesterday.
No.
He did not have a good day. He was not playing good golf yesterday.
He admitted it himself. He's
I worked with him. I asked him if he wanted some pointers.
Sure.
Especially on three woods off the tee, and he was like, "Sure." So we stayed. We worked into the twilight hours, and I fixed him.
That happens though. Guys have bad bullpens, and all of a sudden they go out and they throw a no hitter. You know. So he had maybe a bad round with us yesterday, and now is turning it on at Torrey Pines.
Okay, that's good stuff. Anyway, did you get the did you collect the trophy, the hardware?
No, I found out late last night. So there is apparently going to be stuff sent our way. I don't know if we have trophies or not, but we do at least receive something for our efforts.
We likes to wins the money. That's what we likes to do. We likes to wins the money. Thanks so much, Dan, for carrying us yesterday. Ed Werder will join us. He always has more. He's going to join us at 20 after the hour. Eric Mangini, the man genius, a former head coach with the Browns. I want to get to the Browns in a second, and with the Jets, and with the Patriots. Assistant with the Patriots. Eric Mangini is going to join us later in the show. Kevin Clark from The Ringer is going to join us. We're going to get you ready for the Super Bowl and react to the continued reactions from the weekend. Some of the things Belichick had to say. There's video of Tom Brady, which I found to be interesting. We also have NBA news where Victor Oladipo out for the season and James Harden continues to put up ridiculous numbers. Oh, yeah, and in the National Football League, maybe Antonio Brown will be a Steeler next year. But let's start with the article that I woke up to, and that's Seth Wickersham, who's an outstanding writer for ESPN.com, kind of chronicled the mess that is or it has been the Cleveland Browns. And really, it centers around Jimmy Haslam, who's their owner, who, and I guess I need a little bit of a review course on this. He was a minority owner with Pittsburgh Steelers. He wanted to take some of that Steeler mantra and mentality when he bought the Browns. This is going back to 2012. So if you look, you know, they've owned the team for essentially, you know, 6 years, and they've had five different coaches, right? And it has been a mess. And you'd like to think, or you'd like to give a guy a pass and say, well, maybe it's just bad luck. And then you'd also like to think, well, maybe it's bad. It's bad luck coupled with bad timing, which is also a little bit of luck. And honestly, like, how much is the owner to blame? And Jerry Jones obviously can take a little bit more blame than other owners because he's so hands-on. Whereas Bob Kraft, for example, is mostly hands-off, obviously with the exception of his boy Tom Brady. So different owners own differently. But it's fascinating to me. One of the things that I've gotten accused of at times of my career is, hey, dude, you're too negative. That's because, now, sports radio does have a sense of negativity to it, but when you do it calling games, generally, you go back to the 70s, 80s, even 90s, and some today, announcers tend to err on the side of the positive, especially regional broadcasts. Like if you're the White Sox regional network, you're going to say nice things about the White Sox. One, because that's your boss. You guys technically are collecting checks from the same people. And that's just the way it's done. And sports has always been kind of broadcast that way, where we don't broadcast it. We just gloss over the negative, talk about the positive. Whereas I don't know if I've been negative as much as what I think is realistic. But my thought is always, if you call everything great, when you say something's great that really is great, it doesn't resonate. And I think ownership is the same way. You can't say that all owners are great just because they put up a bunch of money. If everybody was great, then there would be no such thing actually as great. But Jimmy Haslam stepped into a business that he didn't know anything about, that he wanted to know so much about. And with every turn, he seemed to make a calculated mistake. And some of them are really, some of the decisions he made were actually really, really smart. Right? He went and hired Joe Banner, who came out of Philadelphia, and Philadelphia had had such a consistency of success. Then they hired Michael Lombardi, who we have on this show, and he's been successful everywhere he's been. But what he failed to realize is, maybe it's not even on the football acumen, but guys had to be able to work together, and they could not coexist. Could not coexist. And then he ends up firing both of them and hiring, you know, a general manager who was completely in over his head, who absolutely butchered the draft, you know, when he had an opportunity with two first-round picks that was created because of a Joe Banner trade with the Trent Richardson deal. But the more I look at it, I'm an err on the positive side. Hey, guys can, in fact, figure it out. And the moves that were made with the best intentions at heart. But if you want to know why the Browns were so bad, the dysfunction within that organization is in the article. It's right there. And I don't think it comes from a bad place. I think it's a guy who was crazy successful with a family business, running these gas stations and expanding their company tenfold, making himself into a billionaire. Then taking on a football team, which he tries to kind of run like a business. But this is like the conversation about student athletes. Like people say student athletes, well, it's college football is just like a business. Like, no, it's not. You don't pay taxes, right? Your workforce essentially gets insurance and has a barter deal and a trade, only they don't pay taxes and you don't pay taxes on them. You can't fire them. The only people who can fire are the coaches. On the other hand, the coaches are really the linchpin in getting the players to begin with. It's not like any other business on earth. So calling it a business gives you the false sense of security because people who run businesses think it should be run the same and it cannot. The same is true with the NFL. Are there some aspects of business which he failed to address? The idea that people atop your board or people atop your management circle have to be able to coexist and work together? Sure. But there are just some parts to it that are not like any other business on earth. And trying to be a fan for a long time and be a minority owner for a long time and then all of a sudden decide, now am I going to take over a team and hire football people, but I'm going to become a football guy myself? Like, that is a recipe for disaster. And that disaster came out of the oven the two previous years to this one when they won a combined one game over 2 years. That's what it was. It was a recipe for disaster. And if you don't believe me, the recipe was properly put together, cooked up, and you got one win over 2 years. And then hiring John Dorsey, who brings in his own guy as offensive coordinator, who can't get along with the head coach, who is an offensive coordinator in his own right. And then even in the wording of they walk in on Hugh Jackson, who had lost 8 games but had lost 4 in overtime, telling him the team had quit on him. Like, even that is a disaster. And so I read it, and I desperately want to believe that Baker Mayfield can overcome all these odds with Freddie Kitchens and all the talent they've been able to accrue, good and bad, but drafting, you know, top 10 in the draft for what seemed like a decade straight. I'm still left with Jimmy Haslam still the owner. Baker Mayfield seems to have an inordinate amount of power for a guy who, while a rookie and threw for, you know, more touchdown passes than anybody else, also threw a ton of picks and really beat up on the bottom of the league. But more than anything, you know, I mean, look, he was average at best against tough defenses. Actually, he was below average against good defenses. So there's a little bit of a false sense of security in that we absolutely positively have our guy. Like, I'm not convinced they are out of the woods or even close to being out of the woods yet, nor should I be. Because the same guy owns them, and the same guy owning them, trying to figure out how he can get in, how he can leave a mark, how he can be a part of this thing, boy, just it feels like a recipe for disaster. And there is no fun in dysfunction when you're in it, only when you're surrounded, only when you're covering it. So I think it's also one of those deals where I think the term franchise is perfect. It's perfect. Because it's much like, and look, you know, different companies that have franchise themselves have different kind of standards. Have you guys seen what's the one on McDonald's? It's with Michael Keaton. Ramos, have you seen it? The Michael Keaton movie that's about the founder of McDonald's. I think it's called The Founder, isn't it?
Yes, about
yeah, it's called, Ray called Kroc. The Founder, right? Ray, it's about Ray Kroc, who basically, you know, Ray Kroc. If you know anything about McDonald's, like, Dan Byer, you've seen this movie?
I have seen The Founder featuring Michael Keaton.
Okay, so if you remember, like basically, and I'm going to say it was like in Fresno was the first one, or maybe Bakersfield. There were
yeah,
two
I thought
brothers
it was out that, in the IE, I thought it was.
Yeah, and so they had the first ever McDonald's. It's two brothers. They'd had and they had all these great ideas. And Ray Kroc comes in and says, "Hey, I'm gonna start, you know, franchising this thing because I think it's great." And then there was a time where not all the franchises were run at the appropriate level. And so they kind of dialed some back and redid some things. But even to this day, not every franchisee of McDonald's or Burger King or, you know, Dunkin' Donuts or Chick-fil-A or whatever, like, you know, there's different levels of standards. You're not going to, and every franchise isn't going to make the same amount of money, isn't going to have the same amount of success, because even if you have all these things you have to do, and all this money you have to send in, and different standards, there's still, ownership matters. Who runs the thing matters. The decisions they make matter. And if you don't believe me, read this article about the Cleveland Browns and all the missteps they made along the way. They earned one win over 2 years. That was the cake, and the recipe was cooked up over the years leading up to it.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
James Harden has been ridiculous. I mean, just ridiculous. 36 points in the first half. That was good. Ends up with 61 points? 61 points? Wow. Which tied Kobe Bryant for the most by a visiting player in the current version of Madison Square Garden, which technically opened in 68, although was redone a couple years ago to the tune of $1 billion, is the fifth player in NBA history to record multiple 60-point games, joining Elgin Baylor, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, Wilt Chamberlain. Harden also tied Rick Barry with his 14th 50-plus point game. Only Elgin Baylor. Oh, Elgin Baylor, by the way, one of the most underrated historically underrated players in the history of the sport. Elgin Baylor, Kobe, Jordan, and Chamberlain had more. Harden has now 21 consecutive games of at least 30 points. And I don't know if you've seen this. Guys, have you seen this stat about how long it's been since he had an assisted basket that somebody, right, that somebody passed to him for a shot? Have you seen this? That stat is maybe the craziest part. He's scored 263 consecutive points without anybody setting him up. And, like, this thing is cool. It is fun. It is amazing. But it's, one, hard to watch at times, and two, it isn't getting anyone better. It just isn't. Look, there are a lot of logical reasons why, when you have injuries around you, you do what Houston has done. Is like, well, what if we just gave it to our best player and let him make all of the plays? Like, there is a lot. Like, I do it when I'm coaching my son's team. My wife just drives her crazy. Like, why don't you run other plays for other kids? And I was like, because they can't dribble. So we cut that out. Right? You let my little dude make plays, and he makes the right reads. If he's open, he shoots. Now he passes, and his teammates can catch and shoot the basketball. It takes they don't have to make decisions that they're not capable of making. But this has reached a point of ridiculousness. 263 points without anybody assisting at a basket. That means he's not letting anybody else have a chance to create. He's doing everything himself. And that's a mistake. That just doesn't make you better. You know? Just doesn't make you better. And it doesn't make those guys better, because you're going to need them at some point. You need to, even if it's artificially, you need to inflate their confidence. It's one of the things that frankly, Phil Jackson doesn't get enough credit for. He just doesn't. In that he understood that you're playing for the postseason. Everything you're preparing for is for the postseason. Now, do I know that they have injuries? Yeah, I do. Do I think their roster isn't as good as it was before? Of course. Of course. And so here's James Harden, who's, you know, they just signed Kenny Faried, starting Kenny Faried and P.J. Tucker, who can't remember to touch the basketball when it's inbounds. Austin Rivers and Eric Gordon, that's their starting lineup. They're only playing eight guys, and so he has to carry them, and he did. He's only 5 of 20 from three-point range, which is awful. But other than that, I mean, 17 of 38, getting layups and shooting threes, and 22 of 25 from the free throw line. 4 assists, 5 turnovers. I mean, he just had the ball seemingly every time down the court. But if you don't, if it's one thing to emotionally, mentally, in the back of your mind, not trust other players to make plays. But when you just don't trust them to make plays at all, those guys feel that. And there's going to be a time in the playoffs when Harden's either going to run out of gas, going to hit a cold streak, and then you're going to pass it to those other guys and say, hey, we need you to make some buckets. We need you to make some plays. And be like, look, I haven't been doing this all year. You got to give guys just a little bit of taste of success and even a little bit of taste of failure in order to get them ready for when it really, really matters. Because nobody cares how many points he averages, how many crazy games he has. They just don't. I know they're playing without Clint Capella. I know they're playing without Chris Paul, even though he's likely to return very soon. And when you have Chris Paul back, he'll be making some of those plays and take some of the pressure off James Harden. But he's not allowing anybody else to develop. No one else's confidence is developing, because they believe, and based upon the structure of how they're playing, they are solely dependent on James Harden to either create a shot for himself or to create a shot for them.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific.
Let's catch up with our good friend Eric Mangini. You can see him on First Things First and, of course, throughout the Fox family of networks. Of course, former head coach of the Cleveland Browns. I'm going to get to that. Former head coach of the New York Jets and a longtime assistant with the New England Patriots. And Eric, I know you've seen both sides of the Patriots, coaching for and against them. Take me through the first half, though. Like, I thought the first half of football from the Patriots was the best coaching and preparation and execution of a game plan I may have ever seen. What did you see from a coach's eye that most of us missed that allowed the Patriots, they should have gotten out to a 14-0 lead, scoring again right before the end of the half, as they usually do, but they got the opening kickoff, marched down the field, and then got the next punt and then marched down the field. What did you see from the Pats?
Well, the thing that was frustrating to me from the Kansas City perspective, and this is where experience comes into play, is that throughout the whole first half, J.C. Jackson, a rookie free agent from Maryland, who's about 5'10", was on Travis Kelce, man-to-man, with no help. The safety was actually pushing over the top of Tariq Hill, and so that's a situation that should have been exploited. And this is a guy, Doug, that had 10 pass interference penalties in his last 2 years of college. And later on in the game, when they finally got to him, you know, he had two or three in the game. So they let that slide. And then the other thing that New England did really well is take advantage of the way that Kansas City pass sets. They set their tackles so deep. So New England would bring their ends up the field and then come underneath and wrap the tackles around, and they kept Mahomes in the pocket, which was huge. I think that Kansas City missed some great opportunities to move the pocket to get Mahomes out of that box that New England put him in, and then all the plays that Kelce could have had but didn't against a rookie free agent from Maryland.
Why, Eric, did they have to wait till halftime to make some adjustments? Why can't you make adjustments on the fly?
Well, I think as a young player, you go in with this idea of what's going to happen. So they doubled Kelce in the first game, so you assume that Kelsey's going to be doubled again, as opposed to just looking at what's happening. And someone should have gotten to that earlier and said, okay, look, this is what they're doing. We need to get the ball to Kelce. We need to feed it to him. And then from a pass rush standpoint, if they are doing a good job of keeping him in the pocket, because he does so many good things when he's outside of it on those unscripted scrambles, now move him. Make sure that he gets a chance to put the pressure on New England's defense. And they didn't. And when it happened in the second half, and he was able to move around a little bit more, and when they were able to take advantage of the matchup with Kelce, things changed dramatically just too late. I mean, you can't get shut out at home when you've got that type of offense and then decide, okay, we're going to fire Bob Sutton. It's his fault, you know?
Yeah, so then take me to the Patriots' perspective. I know, we could kind of see it coming all year long that they wanted to continue to work on running the football, on being, you know, taking some of the pressure off of Tom, allowing him to, you know, use play action. But also, like, look, there's a reason that they kept a fullback. There's a reason that they drafted Sony Michel in the first round. They wanted to be able to run the football. But part of the game plan was also keeping that it was what people used to do to Tom when you were there, which is keep him off the field. They try to do that to Mahomes, right? Long, sustained drives and just hammering you with running plays. Is that fair that was the Patriots' game plan offensively?
Well, that's absolutely fair, and it worked. And you saw how explosive Kansas City could be. They ended up scoring, 31 points in the 12 minutes of time of possession they had in the second half? Yeah, those long, sustained drives, keeping them off the field. But in terms of running the ball, the other thing it does is it slows down the pass rushers. And they did a nice job of incorporating the runs, but then mixing in the wide receiver screens, using Cordarrelle Patterson not just for gadgets, but as a decoy to set other things up. And that, to me, is another advantage they have with Josh McDaniels and Dante Scarnecchia and the experience of being able to build these packages and then show one thing, the next time show the same look, do something totally different, and now the defense is constantly on their heels as opposed to teeing off and putting pressure on Tom.
They used Burkhead a bunch in the fourth quarter into overtime. Was that because of something they saw matchup-wise or because just the experience that he had knowing he wasn't going to fumble, he was going to do all the little things that, longtime NFL players do, as opposed to Michelle, who has way more upside and did, you know, finish with a touchdown, had a big touchdown run. But was that planned because of experience in a game of that magnitude?
Well, no. Typically, if you're going to the game, you've got some kind of role. You've got some kind of package that you're going to play in. And that was probably the package of plays that they had for him as opposed to the package that they had for Sony or James White. So each guy has a role. And you see the same thing defensively where guys will show up, whether it's on the nickel defense or maybe it's a smaller version of the nickel. There's roles, and as they put in the calls, that's how guys contribute during the course of the game.
Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. We've had others on to discuss this, even Charlie Weiss on to discuss it. Romo calling out where Tom should go or what Tom's going to do. He's the first guy on CBS to do that. But when do you have the same reaction when you see things? Like, is this normal, or was Romo doing something that no other people don't do in the league?
Well, look, Tony's been a really good quarterback, or was a really good quarterback, and he was a guy that had to work hard at his craft, and he studied, and it's apparent when he's calling games. And when you look at it, Tom and most established quarterbacks, if you don't disguise coverage, there's a certain place that you should go with the ball based off of what the weakness is of the defense. And so as Tony looks out there and there's no disguise of the coverage, then you know, okay, Gronk's isolated outside, it's post safety, throw it to Gronk. It's a split safety, you've got two deep safeties, and you've got Julian Edelman motioning in. You know the ball's probably going to go to him on the over route just based off of the pre-snap look. And that's a big part of trying to defeat Tom, is giving him different looks, forcing him to make post-snap decisions.
So, I guess the question, you said, look, there's a lot to the offense that could have protected the defense, but Bob Sutton's defense did get gouged on third down. It was a problem all year, and got gouged, you know, throughout the season as well. Should he have disguised it? Could he have disguised it? Could Bob Sutton have done something differently?
Yeah, you know what? Know what would have really helped is if D Ford lined up on side. If D Ford lines up on side, they picked Tom Brady off three times in one game. And we are having a totally different discussion. And we're talking about what a great job they did. What an amazing job Bob did. But because a guy lines up offsides and negates an interception with 2 minutes left, now he's the guy that gets fired. And look, those third down and long completions, yeah, there were some really good throws. There were some really good catches. There was some excellent execution by New England. But you've also got three pretty good pass rushers up front. There's got to be some accountability there as well. If you have to scheme everything up to get pressure on the quarterback, why are you paying all those guys money, the big money?
Eric Mangini joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Any sense that Tom says, look, man, everybody said we couldn't do it. We did it, and we did it against the Rams. We started this thing against the Rams. I know I could go back and try and get that fight and fight for more, but I'm good. You know, get your sixth Super Bowl ring. They win. You think he shuts it down?
No, I think that one of the things about greatness and Tom is that each time they set a bar, the great ones decide how or figure out how they're going to reset the bar, and that to me is what Tom's doing. And as long as he feels like he can play at a high level, which there's no indication that A, he can't, or B, he's had a change of heart of what he said last year when we were talking about Jimmy Garoppolo, I would imagine win or lose, he'll be back to see if he can do it again.
There's an article out today from the place we used to work about the Cleveland Browns. Steph Wickersham talked about the Cleveland Browns. Now, Jimmy Haslam wasn't the owner when you were there, but it does paint the picture of an immense amount of dysfunction from atop, and that's one of the reasons that franchise has struggled. When you read the article about the Browns, what was your reaction?
This is a conversation that I've had with a couple of owners, and oftentimes owners have been really successful in the industry that they're in. But pro sports is so different, and it's like doing business in China. You're at the mercy of the translator, and you're always going to be at the mercy of the information for an owner that you're given from different people. So the normal things that work don't necessarily work in football, and the normal solutions that you find, that they don't always apply. And sometimes, as much as these guys want to go in and fix problems and they want things to happen right now, it doesn't always work that way. And there's real value to continuity. You know, oftentimes they want you to cook a turkey, but they want it in a microwave. And that's not how it works. And it's not how you create an organization that's sustainable, that can compete for a championship year in and year out. So every year, if you're trying to put out some fire, oftentimes you're just starting three or four fires somewhere else.
Last thing, how egregious do you believe, as a former head coach, the error was from the play caller and Sean Payton not running the ball first and second and third down and decreasing the possibility of the Rams having enough time to kick a game-tying field goal?
Yeah, I don't think that was egregious at all. And he talked about the fact that they got a pressure look, and that's why they checked to the pass. If you go back to the first game against the Rams, the Rams scored with 26 seconds left in the first half. They got the ball back with 26 seconds. They went down and they kicked a field goal. So if they had run the ball three times and eaten up the timeouts, the Rams would have had 50 seconds, and we would have said, well, why wouldn't they put the ball in their best player's hand? Why wouldn't they have given Drew Brees a chance to win the game? And all the time we celebrate, you know, this head coach takes chances, this head coach is a gambler, this head coach is going to win the game. Well, don't be mad at him when he's true to his personality and it doesn't work out. You know, he kicked an onside kick in the Super Bowl. Everybody celebrated that. So you're putting the ball in your best player's hands. Okay, it didn't work out. There's no guarantee they were going to win, even if he did that anyways.
I look forward. I hope you're going to be in Atlanta.
I'm not. I'm going to be in New York doing first things first.
All right, well, I'll be up doing first things first later on in the month. I hope to see you then. In the meantime, thanks so much for your insight, man, and we'll talk to you real soon.
All right, thanks, Doug.
That's the Mangenius, Eric Mangini, joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show.